The time is 7 o'clock, and we're scheduled for the program, so we'll start. My name is Rudy Edmond, and I am a geologist, and I've been coming here to the village for a long time, since 1962. And I also am a teacher. I have been teaching geology at California Lutheran College recently, and prior to that at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. Some years ago, I developed a course that I have been teaching for many years. And tonight I want to summarize that for you in terms of some of the beauty and some of the resources of North America. I think we are very privileged to be citizens and people of this particular continent. And I want to tell you some of the reasons why. So tonight we're going to use some slides, and I'll try and convince you that this is the finest piece of real estate in the world. So let's look at North America then, and I'll turn the house lights on. And by means of a map here, where we can see the entire world, North America has a very unusual setting. The equator, you see, is approximately right through here. North America lies at just the right position between the equator and the North Pole. Furthermore, one of the great things about this particular distribution of land is the fact that the United States, you see, is right here in the middle. And as far as being in the right position between the North Pole and the equator, you couldn't pick a better spot in the world. So let's just kind of recall that as we look through the slides now. And first of all, I want to start out on the East Coast and start from there and proceed across America just to pick up some of the highlights, things that you already know, but we need to be reminded of from time to time. Most of our people come from Europe and came by the Statue of Liberty. And it's interesting to note now that we're refurbishing this statue and that it will stand for a long time. It got kind of shabby, but now it's being replenished and refurbished. This is the coastline of Maine, as those of you may know who have been to the National Park, Acadia National Park up in Maine. One of the most beautiful coastlines, and certainly a rugged one on the east coast of the United States. Then as you come inland into the Appalachian Mountains, Shenandoah National Park is one of the real beauty spots of the eastern part of North America. And this happens to be in the fall of the year when the colors are at their prime. And I would certainly recommend this as one of the beautiful spots. Notice the rounded hills and topography. This is a very different kind of mountains than we see in the western part of the United States. And it's great that we have some variety. These mountains are forested to the very tops and with beautiful trees and all that goes with that kind of scenery. Now, when you go to the north coast up to the Antarctic or to the Arctic Ocean, you see, and get up to the northern part of Alaska. This is the area right around Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, where the caribou herds slosh through the water you see in the tundra here. And this has its own kind of beauty. There are no trees, only the kinds of things that you see in the immediate foreground, but beautiful in its own right and very different. Then, of course, in Alaska, one of the beauties that we see are the well-preserved glaciers, where you can get right up close to them and really observe them firsthand. So this is one of the glaciers, of which there are many, of course, in the Alaska area. Now, in the Midwest part of the United States, there are many things of beauty also. This, you will recall, many of you have been on this. This is the Wisconsin Dells. The Dells of the Wisconsin River. And it's hard to find a more beautiful spot in central North America than that particular area. But not to overlook the fact that much of the beauty lies in the farmland that we see. This is a slide taken out of an airplane window and could be anywhere in Iowa, Illinois. It happens to be around Galesburg, Illinois, and in that general area. Just one beautiful field after another across the countryside. Coming west, we are all acquainted with Old Faithful, and this is Old Faithful Geyser in Yellowstone National Park, and one of the truly scenic spots in North America, and for that matter in the world. So this is Yellowstone. Then right south of Yellowstone are the beautiful Teton Mountains, from Mount Moran here on the south to the Grand Teton here. And as you see, there are no foothills in the foreground. You come right along Jackson Lake here, and there's a big fault that raises this whole block, almost 10,000 feet. And so you face this wonderful display of mountains immediately in the foreground. So within a matter of 3 or 4 miles horizontally, you're up here at 14,000 feet. And this is one of the most spectacular fault block mountains in the world. And it's one of our great national parks. If you hike deep into the Tetons, this is one of the lakes up at about 11,000 feet. And you see this is the Grand Teton, Mount Owen and Tiwanat from this particular spot, Lake Solitude. And this involves a hike of about 11 miles. Or you can get horses to take you in there to see that beauty spot. Now, if you go on the other side of the Tetons, you see, here's the Grand Teton again. Now we're on the Idaho side, where the Idaho potatoes are. And here's a potato patch right up next to the Tetons on the Idaho side. And that has a different kind of beauty, because here now we have the foothills. And the main peaks and the main front of the range is hidden, you see, behind these foothills. But that's another way of viewing the Teton Mountains in Wyoming. Now, going down into Arizona, one of the beautiful things that you see are great fields of sunflowers. These are all wild. And this field is just a blaze of color in the summer when the sunflowers are out. And from that, of course, has been cultivated the sunflowers that we raise and cultivate and raise for their seed and so on. So it's an area that's of great interest to us, even from its bounty as well as its beauty. Now, also in the Arizona area, beautiful red rocks where everything is exposed. The vegetation is very sparse, but the rocks are very colorful. So that the beauty of this really lies in the sparse vegetation and the color of the rocks that are exposed. And it's just a panorama of changing colors as you view that particular area. Then you go to Bryce Canyon, and here the erosion has produced minarets of all descriptions. Beautiful rock that's colorful and also displays an unusual form. So this is one of our beautiful national parks, Bryce Canyon. Here's the Painted Desert. And the Painted Desert is just what it sounds like. It's just a splash of color. And you see a broad expanse of this in Arizona. Now, nothing can really be more beautiful in the northern part than the Northern Cascades. And here we are on Lake Chelan, one of the beauty spots of the Northwest. And this is Lake Chelan, of course, that goes on up to Stehekin, and this is our dock. And of course, we're all familiar with Main Street and the program here at Holden Village, and this certainly is one of the highlights of the North American continent. We're privileged to be right next to Glacier Peak National, the area here, which is truly wilderness, and this is an unusual opportunity to see that part of North America. In California, of course, we have the beautiful canyon of the Yosemite, And here's Half Dome and El Capitan and this beautifully glaciated canyon, which is a landmark for all of the world. People come from all over to visit Yosemite National Park. Then, looking at the sequoias all along the west coast, and this is just one of the giants, and I think this happens to be maybe the biggest one, but there are many all along the west coast, and the Sequoia Forest, Sequoia National Park, is certainly one of the beauty spots of western North America. Then, even in the intermontane basins of the west coast, this happens to be near our home, the Ojai Valley in Southern California. And you can see that it's just a series of mountains and valleys. And this kind of picture could be taken in many places in the southern part of the west coast area of the coastal ranges. And then the beach of the Pacific. And the beaches, of course, stretch all the way from Canada all the way down into Mexico on all of the west coast area. And this is just one representative shot in that particular area. Now, let's look at the Earth from another point of view. Now you're on the moon and you're looking at the Earth. And you can see, obviously, that there's activity here. Now, what you see, of course, are cloud formations hiding much of the land and the water. But it's very obvious that we live on a dynamic Earth, an Earth that is changing and is constantly in motion. We see from this photo the motion in the atmosphere. And then in other ways we can learn of the motion that's within the Earth proper. Now, I want to just show you a map here again that'll outline, for example, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which comes right down through here and separates, you see, Africa from South America, Europe from North America. And here is Iceland right on that mountain chain, which is buried. A wonderful set of mountains that we don't see and don't appreciate because it's not exposed. But North America starts really at that point and all the way across to the west coast, over into here. And it's moving in this general direction against this particular part of the Earth's crust. And that has had much to do with what we see as we look farther south, coming south from California. Here we pick up another one of these buried mountain ranges out in the ocean floor that ties finally, you see, to Australia and to the other side of the Pacific Ocean. So this is another view of North America. Now, what's going on in this area? If you just remember that last map, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, this is the sort of thing that's happening. Down in here, the Earth is mobile and has convection cells, you see, that are going around here. And the material is coming out here, and it's moving that way and moving this way. This is a cartoon, you see, which would represent North America. This represents Europe. And you see along the west coast of North America, here we have the volcanoes and the mountains and so on. And so this is a kind of a cartoon that illustrates what's happening. Now, where we are here on the west coast, we have the Pacific Ocean crust going under the North American crust. And here then are the volcanoes that are coming up, like Mount St. Helens and Mount Rainier, Glacier Peak, and others, you see. Again, a cartoon which shows something of what's going on the west coast. Now, beautiful mountains, of course, come from this kind of activity. And this is Denali, Mount McKinley, up in Alaska, the highest mountain of the west coast, and is one of the truly spectacular sights of North America. Now, here's the Southern California area where we live, and the San Andreas Fault, which all of you know, comes right down through here and down in through like this. So all things are happening here in terms of the dynamic Earth. And that's part of what's going on, you see, and it's going on today. This is an orange grove, and look at what's happened. You can see, this is the shifting of the Earth's crust, where it's moving horizontally, and it's just pushed the rows out of line. Well, you can't argue with a photo like this. You know, it is happening, and it's happening right now, and that's a good illustration of the kind of thing that's going on. You drive along the highway, not far from Los Angeles, and you see this kind of rock, all bent and twisted, you see. This is a part of the San Andreas Fault, the part of that movement, you see. So that here it shows very dynamically and dramatically what the action really is. Now, when we look at Western North America again, here's Mount St. Helens. And these are the volcanoes that are active, relatively active. Here is one down in Mexico, and you see Mount St. Helens, and we have volcanoes all along this area. And then we come over here and pick up the Japanese volcanic activity, and all around the Pacific. So you see, we're a part of that. And North America is very much involved, you see, in that part of the Pacific. Now, on the East Coast, you notice things are quiet. And we don't have that kind of volcanic activity. But when we get over here, then we have Iceland and a new island, Surtsey Island, which has formed on the mid-Atlantic ridge, where it's exposed up in the northern hemisphere. Now, you go south into Guatemala and Central America, a whole string of volcanoes really dot the landscape. And this is just one area. Where the volcanoes are very prominent right around Lake Atitlan. This is Lake Atitlan in Guatemala, and a beautiful spot in Central America. Now, here is Mount St. Helens, and this is the volcano that became active, as you recall, very recently, and reminds us that the volcanic activity continues as we go through time and observe these processes at work. We can expect this sort of thing to happen occasionally on the West Coast, and sure enough, it happened at Mount St. Helens. It has happened in the past to produce some of the most beautiful scenery we have. Here is Crater Lake and Wizard Island, and you see this particular volcanic activity dates back about 6,500 years. And then, of course, we have our own volcano right nearby, which is Glacier Peak, where similar kinds of activity occurred about 12,000 years ago. So we can see that as time goes on, things continue to happen. Now, here is the Columbia River and the basalts of the Columbia River, the great lava flows that came out in this part of Washington. And so this Columbia River highway and this particular view is one of the great sites of the Pacific Northwest. And here you just see one representative sample of it. If you follow the volcanics again that extruded, you go over into Yellowstone, and one of the most beautiful canyons of the world from a point of view of color is Yellowstone Canyon in Yellowstone National Park. And the reason it is so colorful is that the hot water associated with the volcanoes there has changed the minerals in the rock to produce a variety of yellows and browns and tans and so on, so that you get a great spectacle of color within the canyon, as well as the beautiful water in the bottom of it and the waterfalls. Now, here's a different kind of volcanic activity that we see down in California. This is the Devil's Post pile, and it looks like posts, and you could easily believe this. And that has happened because when the lava flowed out, it started to cool from the surface up here, and it developed cracks in the rock as the rock got shrank in terms of volume as it cooled. And these cracks went right on down to the bottom of the lava flow. And so you see one of the beautiful sights of Devil's Post Pile in California. The Grand Canyon needs no special introduction. We know that's one of the great scenic spots of the world. And here you're looking down from the Colorado Plateau, which is about 5,000 feet above the sea level. The bottom of the canyon, you see, there's a drop here of almost a full mile where the Colorado River has worked its way down as this whole area was lifted up and it formed a large dome. And Colorado River worked right down through that as it rose very, very slowly. And so that has produced the Grand Canyon of the Colorado, which again is one of the great sights of the Southwest. On the coastline of California, this rivals the coastline of Maine. And as you go into Central and Northern California, you can see that the shoreline is very young. It has very few beaches in some areas, and it's very actively being uplifted. So that new coast is forming and new beaches are being created and so on. Now I want to turn our attention to some of the activity that goes on in terms of ice and snow. This is the Athabasca Glacier, which is just north of us, a short distance. And here you see the remnants of one of the important glaciers of the Canadian Rockies and the debris that was being carried by the ice as it pushed this material down the valley off of the Columbia ice fields up in here. And that is one of the spectacular glaciers of that particular part of the country. Now, here's a glacial deposit that's right here in our own area. And this shows you the kind of material, rock all mixed together, fine and coarse, and so on. And that is a very important resource for North America because in many places this kind of material has provided for the main soil that we have in the agricultural area. Now let's take a look at North America from the point of view of its resources. We've seen something of its beauty. Now let's look at what we have in the way of natural resources. And I want to take you up into this area. And then we'll look at different things that relate to the North American continent. But again, you can see that one of the most important things that we have in North America is the Mississippi River, which happens to come right in here between the two mountain areas and comes right up the central part of North America. And do you realize that when you're clear up here at the Great Lakes, you're only about 700 to 1,000 feet above the sea, which is down here. So it's essentially flat, you see, throughout this whole area. And it provides the greatest agricultural area in all of the world. This is the food basket of North America. And not only that, but the greatest one in all of the world. And I want to come back to that a little later. But let's look at some of the other resources that we have in North America. Here is where the old rock is, where the crystalline rocks are. Now it happens that most often the various kinds of metals are associated with these kinds of rocks. And you can see that this is an area which has produced lots of iron and copper and silver and zinc and gold and many other things, and has been a very important part of both Canada and the northern part of the United States up in here. Now, up in here, of course, is the sliver that comes down into our particular mountain range and also provides for the kinds of materials that we have right here in this valley. And so that's the part of the grain of North America. Here is the iron mines of northern Minnesota and Michigan, and these were some of the richest iron ores in the world. And that's really what made Detroit what it is. is the fact that we had this kind of material available, which simply could be scooped up and took almost no processing, could go directly to the steel mills, and right next to it were the copper of the Keweenawan Peninsula, and then you had the Great Lakes to haul it all through the industrial area. And so this is the backbone of North America being mined out here. Now, the unfortunate thing is that we have already mined it out. And now we're down from iron ore that was 60 to 70% iron down to where it's now 35% iron. And it's very costly to extract the iron from what's left after they worked out these important deposits of iron. So we've had a great resource. It has built our country. And now we have to deal with what's left, mainly what's in the banks here that were left because it was considered worth doing. Now we're only digging in the banks that are left, and we have none of the good stuff down at the bottom. So that's a part of our history, but it represents the wealth of North America. Now, I just show you a slide here to show you that in one of the important areas, we have coal. And the coal really is related to what happened in connection with the development in Pennsylvania and the Pennsylvanian time. Great sequences of coal. And we are one of the blessed nations of the world in terms of our coal deposits. And this is a part of our history. Here is just a sample, you see, of the coal that's available all through the Midwest, the western part of the United States, and the East. So we have coal in many places and in great abundance. Unfortunately, we've not been very good stewards in digging up some of the coal, and we've left some very bad scars. This happens to be a beautiful cornfield in southern Illinois, which will no longer ever raise corn. The coal is all gone, and this is what's left. There's some recreational area that can be used, but from the point of view of its productivity, we've used it and it's gone. Here's where a mine underneath the cornfield, which you can obviously see, has simply caved in. And so we get scars of this kind that results from the production of this particular resource. We are one of the great nations in terms of production of oil. And there are only two major areas in the world that produce more oil today than the United States. And that is the Soviet Union, which produces the most, and Saudi Arabia, which is second, but Saudi Arabia could be first anytime it wants, and North America is third. And we produce a lot of the oil that we have, but since 1970, we are using more oil than we can produce, so we have to import about 40% of all the oil that we're using today, simply because our demand for oil is much greater than what we can pump out of the ground in North America. And we're at the point now where that picture is not going to change. So we're going to rely on foreign sources for oil more and more as the time goes on. And the only alternative to that is to use our oil shale. And that's very expensive, and we don't like to think of the implications of that. We have wonderful deposits in the offshore connected with salt domes down in the Louisiana area, down in the Gulf Coast. And this is the kind of thing. All of these black patches here are oil fields that are waiting to be tapped. But we don't have much of this left on land, so we have to go offshore. And there are still important deposits being found offshore, but not as fast as we use it. We use it faster than we can find it. So our reserves go down every year and have gone down steadily since the 1970s. Now, here's one of the platforms. We don't sometimes like to have these. Santa Barbara, you know, is very upset about the fact that we have oil platforms off in the and the Pacific Ocean, the Gulf of Mexico, and so on. But this is the only place we have left to look. We have exhausted what's on land. This is the pipeline that comes out of Alaska from Prudhoe Bay. And through that pipe today flowed 1.5 million barrels of oil, 42 gallons to every barrel. And by tomorrow, we will have used all of that, and we will have imported another 40%, you see. So we use it all, and it's gone, but that's one of the great bounties of North America, and that's the biggest oil field ever found in North America. It was up on the North Slope of Alaska, and it is still producing, but it has yielded about 1/3 of all the oil that it will produce, ultimately. So we need to find more as time goes on to replenish it. Here you can see, it's a huge pipeline, and it flows 1.5 million barrels every day. We have gold panners, and we have gold. And of course, this fellow was out in the Black Hills, but we had a gold rush in California. And we're still panning for gold in California. And to some degree, this will go on, you know. But we are not a nation that has lots of gold. Our major gold mine is in Lead, South Dakota, the home state mine. But we do still have some gold in this country. We have many sites in the West where dams, important dams, you see, can be constructed. And these provide for hydroelectric power. So that's an important source of a resource that we have in the western states where the topography is such that large reservoirs can be captured. This is the Grand Coulee Dam, you see here in Washington, and provides a tremendous amount of electricity for this part of Washington and the Pacific Northwest. New York City could not exist except for the bounty of North America. You see, they produce no food, but here is a tremendous concentration of population and buildings, and this is just representative of our big cities, which rely on the resources of our country to provide for all that we need to have a good life in North America. So this is just to remind us that the cities must be supported by the land that lies outside of the cities and the productivity of that land. Now, as we look here at the developed countries and the underdeveloped countries, you can see that this symbol is for food. You know, a country that exports more food than we can eat. And then you look at the food importers, and you see that all of the gray and all of the colors represent areas where food is being imported in order to supply the population of the area. Australia and ourselves and some small parts of South America are the only places where there is an adequate, really an adequate supply of food so that we export it. And one of the things you notice that the color for rice, this green color here, much of the world where the population is the greatest relies on rice, and we're an exporter of rice because we basically don't eat much rice. We prefer other foods which are more to our taste, so we export our rice. Now, let's look at what the ice and the glaciers have done for the world. This is the northern hemisphere, the present day. This is the way it looked during the time of the ice age. And you notice that the ice moved down into this part of North America. It moved down into Europe. And so both countries were favored. And in this area, the best rock and soil was brought down right into the part of North America where the water is adequate and where the temperature is right. And so it provides for a wonderful base for soil and so on. So let's look on. Here's the kind of thing you're accustomed to seeing as you drive through Iowa and Illinois. Road cuts of all kinds, which shows loose material brought in by the ice. Now, that's a great storage area for water and moisture, and it's clay, and it's fine material. And so when they get a drought in the Midwest, this water simply works up to the surface by capillary action, because in some places this kind of loose material is 200-300 feet thick, because the ice brought it down in such quantities and left it in Iowa and Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, you see, and southern Wisconsin, and so on. So that's a great product that was handed to us by the ice. Now, this is the western part where we have dry farming. And you can see that this is a field that's being farmed this year, but the fields on both sides are left fallow so that they can accumulate enough moisture for the next year. Great wheat raising country, but not so good for corn and that kind of thing. Now, we're in southern Iowa, and you could take this kind of a picture almost anywhere across Iowa. Here, bean and corn fields, beautiful buildings, and exceptionally rich farms and farmland. And this is the breadbasket of the world. Here's the corn, the kind of corn you grow in that part of the country. And if you look closely, you see, I didn't put a scale in here, but that's as high as an elephant's eye, you know, and more. And then when you look at the stocks, there's more than one ear on many stocks. And so this is very, very productive kinds of land. Then we come to the west, and we have forests, great forests. And here are some beautiful trees. You see a stand, and this one happens to be in the Northern Cascades. In fact, if you hike to Holden Lake, you hike through this. And that's Douglas fir. And there are many, many forests all through the Pacific Northwest, and that's one of the basic resources of the part of country where we're in. We are replacing the trees that we're cutting, and we're being reasonable stewards in trying to protect the forests of our own country. And we need to be very aware that when we cut a tree, we should plant a tree. And hopefully we have learned or are learning that lesson so that we don't deplete that resource. The bottom line for North America in terms of its wealth is its soil. And here you see different kinds of soil. But that thin layer right at the top is what makes the difference, you see, between a productive land and a non-productive one. And we happen to be very favored in having this kind of material from which soil can be made. And it has all of the mineral ingredients, and so with nature's processes, here you can see the rock being broken down. The water that accumulates in this deposit simply breaks this down to clay. And then we have a good base for soil, which is clay and sand and the vegetation that goes along with it. But one of our problems too is erosion. And you can see here how the roots tend to hold, but erosion where there's over-cultivation and anything else, so we're losing a lot of our top soil in many places. We have not really been concerned about that because we raised more food than we can eat, so why worry about the soil? But time moves on, and we need to be more conscious of our obligation to be a source of food for other parts of the world as well. Here is a picture taken from a satellite of the Mississippi River. Now you can see the Mississippi River flowing here in the floodplain. Now all of this floodplain is soil that mainly came from the northern states, and it's moving south, and it's moving in the direction of the Gulf Coast and the delta at the end of the Mississippi River. These are basically floodplains and a very rich kind of material. And here is the delta now of the Mississippi River, which is being built out each year. by soil coming from Iowa and Illinois and all of the glacial area. And so as erosion makes the rivers muddy, then the soil winds up in the Gulf of Mexico, and we have no way of retrieving that. So that is a problem for us. We also have some dust storms. And this is one picture that I took in the dust storms of the 30s when I happened to be driving through Kansas. And just in a matter of minutes, you know, we were into this where you couldn't even see the road. And we just had to stop until the storm finally blew through. So millions of tons, you see, of soil are being carried in that way. But we also contend with this kind of machinery for developing the best farmland into places for shopping centers and homes, suburbia, and all the spread from the cities out onto the good agricultural areas. It's hard to be tender with the earth when you have this kind of power to really go after it. And this was a beautiful field before those machines really got into it. Now you see it's all being leveled off into pads, and this is right near our home, and by the time we get back this summer, this will all be houses. And it was, you see, a good agricultural area. Well, here are our friends, the moose and a couple of little calves. The question is, who speaks for all of the animals that cannot speak? We are the only one in God's creation who can really look out for what God has provided. And he has provided very abundantly. But it'll be up to us to see that this abundance continues. So we have a great bounty to protect. And the most important thing we have to protect probably is our soil and our water. Because this is where it is. We export, you see, about 46% of everything we raise at the present time. But that day will come as the population of the world increases, where more and more people will have to rely on what we are able to raise in this country, because they have great difficulty raising it in their country. And here is a soil profile. The top soil is really what is most important. And the minerals and the rock, you see, that form the subsurface here and the subsoil. And then, of course, the sun, the solar energy, and the water. It's all wrapped up right in here. And we are the greatest productive country in the world from the point of view of raising food, and we need to be very aware of that and protect it. Here you can see again a map which shows the rich countries and the poor countries. The white are the countries that are rich in resources. We're also rich in terms of beauty and scenery and all of that, but you can see that there is no country that compares with the North American continent in terms of its productivity and in terms of its scenery. It stands very high. Europe would be a great source of material, and here's Russia. But the big problem, and I want to point this out, and that you remember it, is the ventilation system. The warm, moist air moves north from the equator to the poles, and it moves south. But the earth now rotates this way. And so as the air moves north, laden with water, where does it go? It gets backed up into North America here, and it's funneled. It's funneled right from the Gulf of Mexico between the Appalachian Mountains and the Rocky Mountains. It comes right up here, and we get just the right amount of rain, you see, because of that. Now, let's look at Europe by contrast. Here's the equator and where the warm, moist air comes against the mountains. And now we have mountains that go all the way across southern Europe. And the mountains trap the moisture. And that means that the moisture does not get across into Russia. And so they tend to have crop failures. for that reason. While North America, you see, has abundance of wheat, corn, and all the grains, this area tends to be neglected because the air can't get through. It simply is forced up on the mountains and it comes out as snow. While here, it's warm, moist air that goes all the way up into Canada before it hits anything that's high in terms of the mountains, and the precipitation then is carried on through. And that is really what makes North America the great agricultural country that it is. And with that, I want to thank you and tell you that I think this is a great piece of real estate in the world. Thank you.